Before we dive into today's discussion, we've got a special resource just for you, a free ebook called Does It Make Sense to Believe in God? In today's world, where faith is often labelled as outdated or irrational, this ebook takes a fresh look at the evidence for God. It features reflections from years of engaging with some of the world's leading atheists, like Richard Dawkins, and reveals why, after hearing every conceivable argument, our confidence in God's existence is stronger than ever. Download Does It Make Sense to Believe in God today for free at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, let's get on with today's show.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, Dr. John White. Hi, John.
Hi, it's good to be here. And again, as previously, we're sitting side by side instead of speaking over the internet.
Yeah. Today we wanted to pick up on a really tragic case that lots of you will have heard about that's been in the news a lot over the last weeks and months, and that's the story of Archie Battersby. It's a really sad story of a 12-year-old boy who was the subject of a very bitter, contested legal battle after he ended up in a coma in hospital, and the doctors wanted to turn off his life support, and his family fought for many months through the courts to prevent that. And in the end, the courts ruled that the doctors could withdraw his life support, and he passed away in August. It raises a lot of really fascinating and challenging ethical questions. But I guess we want to acknowledge at the beginning, John, that this is also a story that's deeply personal, deeply painful.
Yes, it is. I think that so many of the major ethical and legal dilemmas which we face in modern medicine is actually, they start with human pain. They start with people with tragic and devastating tragedies. And Archie's sad story is a classic example. And so I think we must really be careful not to just reduce this to a kind of abstract, philosophical, theological, ethical discussion, and constantly bear in mind that we're dealing with real people and an ultimate tragedy for any parent to face this sudden shock of a much loved child who then appears to have been attempting some kind of experiment with putting a ligature around his neck and was found hanging from the neck at home and who was subsequently resuscitated and waiting for the ambulance to turn up and CPR continuing, and then the ambulance continuing, and so on. It brings a sort of a shock of horror to any parent's heart to think that they might be in that situation.
That's right. I mean, it's almost unimaginable, isn't it? And so, just to recap the story for people who haven't been following it too closely, as you say, Archie was at home in April, and he was found by his mum to be unresponsive, because he had tied something around his neck. We believed it was maybe part of an online prank or a challenge. We're not sure why. He was rushed to hospital and quickly was put on mechanical ventilation and other life support measures. But quite quickly, the hospital team concluded that he was probably brain dead. He could not recover, and actually it was right to withdraw treatment. But his family strongly resisted this conclusion, believing that, or even hoping and praying maybe for a miracle that he could come back to them, and this basically led gradually over the course of days and weeks to the hospital in the end applying to the courts for permission to withdraw treatment, or well, first permission to test his brainstem activity to see if he was really brain dead.
Yeah. So what had happened was that the blood supply and oxygen supply to the brain had been cut off for a long period. It was not possible to know exactly how long it was, but it was a period of probably 15, 20, 30 minutes or more. And tragically, when that happens, a whole series of damaging chemical reactions are started in the brain, which leads to irreversible damage. And then the brain starts to swell and the blood supply to the brain is increasingly impaired. And it became apparent to the doctors really very early on that irreversible brain damage had happened, and that his life was only being sustained by massive intensive care support. And so one of the there are many complex and difficult issues that this case raises, but a fundamental question is about the definition of death. And it may be worth just going having a quick aside on that and just looking at a modern understanding of what death actually involves. So historically, you know, all the way up until the 1950s, 1960s, there was only one way to die, and that was by your heart stopping. It was it was recognized that permanent cessation of the circulation was the definition of death. And there really was no debate about that among doctors, and the doctors diagnosed death. One of the foundational things was listening for a long time, feeling for major pulses, ensuring that the heart had stopped, and that once you look for other signs as well, such as the fixed and dilated pupils and lack of response to stimulation, but it's really permanent cessation of the circulation which underlay the definition of death.
And I suppose that begins to change in the last kind of half century or slightly longer, once new techniques come around where we can actually start effectively kind of keeping people alive mechanically, keeping their hearts pumping and their lungs going even after they're unable to do that by themselves.
That's right. And so it's really in the 1960s that the techniques for keeping people alive mechanically using life support technology, and particularly mechanical ventilators, giving intravenous drugs to maintain the circulation and so on. As this is developing, it's becoming increasingly apparent that it's possible to sustain biological life even when a very severe illness and irreversible damage to the brain and to other organs has occurred. And so there was continuing debate going on between doctors in particular and other experts about what to do in this situation, because if we're able to keep the heart beating indefinitely, does it make sense to say that this patient, it's only death can only occur when eventually all the organs, despite carrying on maximal intensive care, all the organs have permanently deteriorated.
And so what we're really saying is that historically deaths was kind of obvious, or at least it was a pretty black and white issue, and suddenly the medical profession and kind of everyone related with that has suddenly trying to work through this kind of grey area, because what does it mean to be dead is no longer as obvious as it once was, now that we could really, in some instances, keep people kind of going indefinitely.
That's right. And it's one of the fascinating recurring themes which you see in the history of medicine. And that is, every time medical technology advances and becomes capable of some new intervention, it seems to raise some of these age-old questions about what it means to be human. And here is a classic example where we're all having to think much more deeply about what we actually mean by death, precisely because the technology is now capable of keeping someone alive. And so to begin with, it was really the ability to keep people alive. There's no doubt also that the possibility of organ transplant was also in the mix here, because questions about the fundamental rule behind organ transplantation has always been the so-called dead donor rule, that organs can only be transplanted, and particularly an organ such as the heart or the liver, which once the patient is dead. And if the patient is not dead, then organs cannot be transplanted. But once some new definition of death emerged, and this was really started in the 1960s in the USA, this a new concept came, and that was that in addition to death due to the circulatory death, there was another possibility that death could occur by neurological criteria. And the concept came that if there was irreversible and permanent loss of all brain function, so if the brain function became such that it stopped working and it could never, there was irreversible loss of integrated neurological function, that too could be defined as death. And so in the USA, the concept became then of brain death, that the brain was effectively dead. And so even if the heart is still beating, even if the ventilation is maintaining the lungs, even if the patient is still able to have metabolic function and excretory function, if the brain is irreversibly damaged and not functioning, then the definition of brain death was made in the USA.
And I suppose lying behind that, maybe almost unspoken, is a philosophy or a set of values that says, without a brain, you can't live, or without a brain functioning normal, life is not worth living. I mean, has there been kind of criticism of that, saying that kind of reduces human beings simply to kind of brains in jars, and that actually the brain is just one organ of many, and why should we give it this kind of priority and this precedence?
So it's very interesting to see that once this had been proposed, this new definition of brain stem or brain whole brain death had been proposed, the vast majority of ethicists, doctors, philosophers, and indeed Christian thinkers accepted this new understanding of death, and therefore they did implicitly accept that the brain and the integrated function of the brain was absolutely central to our understanding of what life means. Over the subsequent years, since the 1960s, there has been an increasing tendency among some theologians and ethicists to start to question this concept and say, as you say, are we really valuing the brain? Why should it be that the brain is the single organ that we regard as essential to life? And surely, in biblical thinking, it's the whole body, not just the brain, which is important.
And I think everyone can understand that if a person, you know, couldn't, if their heart would fail naturally, we can give them a pacemaker or some other kind of artificial intervention that keeps their heart beating. And clearly that person is the same person, they're still alive and they could live for many years. And that, people feel, intuitively makes a lot of sense. But people rail against the idea that maybe we could replace the brain, or if the brain is not working, they could just lie there in a bed, but we could keep them alive for years. People feel uncomfortable about that. Is that simply because what we do, Christians or otherwise, implicitly kind of reify, put on a pedestal our thinking capacity, and say, perhaps in a kind of unbiblical way, if you can't think and you can't rationalize, then it doesn't matter that the rest of your body works fine, you are effectively dead?
Well, and I think these are profoundly difficult and complicated questions. I think there's no doubt that we understand much more of the way that the human body works compared to previous generations. And there, you know, if you go back to biblical times, it was thought that the principal seat of the person was in the central organs. It was in the heart, but it was also included in the bowels. It was included in the core organs. That's the core of where we are. I mean, many people thought the brain was a relatively minor and unimportant organ. It's really only with the development of modern science that we now understand the central importance that the brain does play. And it's not just in terms of the rational thinking, because it's the brain which plays the role of integrating, holding together all the other organs within the body. And therefore, tragically, when Archie's case, once the brain has become irreversibly and catastrophically damaged, what you can see that bit by bit, all the other organs of the body are starting to disintegrate, their function is deteriorating, because this central integrative role of the brain is lost.
So as far as I understand it, the US developed this concept of whole brain death. But actually, the UK has a slightly different approach to determining death, and they actually or doctors are kind of told in good practice guidelines that you can determine death simply if the brain stem shows no activity. Could you just explain the difference between those two approaches?
Yes, it's quite a sort of complex and technical area, but what has tended to happen in the US is in order to determine that the brain as a whole has died, is that in addition to doing clinical tests, the general practice is to do a whole number of other investigations, including electrical tests, sometimes measuring the blood flow to the brain and so on. And it's by showing that you get these very abnormal tests which show if effectively the brain function is very severely impaired or is absent, then you can use that for defining death. In the UK, the experience and the standard approach has been that it's not essential to do all these other tests, because by doing very careful clinical examinations, we are able to determine whether or not there is any kind of neurological function going on within the brain simply by clinical examinations. And provided those clinical tests are done very carefully and done independently by skilled neurologists or clinicians, then it is possible to determine that if there's absolutely no response to these tests, then all the evidence is that recovery is impossible, that consciousness is absent, and that there the effectively irreversible damage to the brain has occurred. And so part of the controversy that happened in Archie's case, the case of this tragic boy, was that the doctors wanted to carry out this set of tests. It includes things like seeing if the child responds to stimulation, if there's any evidence of pain, checking in the eyes, seeing whether the pupils respond to light, checking whether particular reflexes in the cranial nerves are present, and in particular then disconnecting the patient from the ventilator for a number of minutes and to see whether or not the respiratory movements will commence. And if all of those things are negative, if there's absolutely no response in any of those, then it's possible, and they have to be repeated, the tests repeated on more than one occasion by independent observers. If you meet all those criteria, then in the UK, the definition of death is met. But when the doctors suggested to the parents that that's what they like to do, unusually, the parents actually refused permission for the doctors to carry out those tests to see whether or not Archie met these criteria for brainstem death.
And you've probably, in your own medical practice as a doctor, probably had some similar or related things where you've had to kind of have difficult conversations with parents of children and asked to do examinations. Is it common for parents to disagree, or do most of the time are parents and doctors on the same page?
Well, I think this is a fundamental issue in this case, and I think we're probably going to come back to this, but tragically, it seems that from very early on, maybe within the first day or two of the child arriving in hospital for full life support to be instituted and so on, it seems that sadly there was a breakdown in trust between the parents and the clinical team. And increasingly, the parents came to the position where they genuinely didn't believe that the doctors and nurses, the clinical team caring for their child, were genuinely trying to do the best for their child. They became increasingly suspicious, and therefore, whenever the doctors suggested doing something instead of normally, I mean, my experience as a doctor is that when you carefully suggest that you want to carry out this test and this is the reason for doing it, it's pretty unusual for parents to say, "Oh no, I don't want you to do any of those tests, doctor." But I think it does demonstrate that sadly, right from fairly early on, there was a very major breakdown of trust.
And that's how they end up in court in the first place, isn't it? Because the hospital in the end says, well, we want to carry out this test of Archie's brainstem to determine if he is dead. And if we can't get the permission of the parents, they basically apply to the court to override that and give them permission to do it anyway.
That's right. So the way that the law works in the UK is that whenever we're caring for a child, providing medical treatment, there has to be agreement and collaboration between the parents and the doctors as to what is in the child's best interests. So the law right from the beginning says that both doctors and parents have a duty in law to act in their children's best interest, to do the best for their child, to do everything that is going to promote the child's welfare and functioning and development and so on. And provided that doctors and parents can agree together on what is in their child's best interests, then the law courts say, we don't want to be involved. We, by and large, doctors and parents are able to agree together on what to do for the best for their children. And it's only in the relatively rare cases where there's a complete irreconcilable breakdown between the parents and the doctors about what is the right thing to do, that at that point, the law courts say, well, there has to be some mechanism to break the deadlock where there is irreconcilable disagreement. And therefore, the only way we can break the deadlock is to use the whole panoply of the law and of the family or the high courts, which then see these cases.
To Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And so the judge basically hears evidence from the medical side about what they found, what the reasons for wanting to withdraw treatment, or in this case, do the brainstem test. And then they hear from the parents and the family and their views. And you can read the judgment. This has been published online. We'll put a link to it in the description, which shows how the judge kind of very methodically and carefully went through all the different evidence from both sides, didn't kind of prioritize or give higher weight to doctors over the parents, heard their views. And then the test is, what do I believe, having heard all this evidence, is in the best interests of Archie?
Yeah, now, interestingly, the British system says we don't only have a legal team for the doctors and a legal team for the parents. We actually, the court will then appoint a separate legal team precisely for the child. And so there's a department of the official guardians there was a court appointed legal team specifically for the child, which is separate from the parents. And the idea is that the child, there is somebody in the court to represent the child and say, I'm here to speak on behalf of the child. Yes, the parents want this and the doctors want this, but actually I'm here to speak on behalf of the child.
And that's, I guess, part of the effort is to try and unpick what exactly is the best for the child. The child, Archie, obviously couldn't tell us his own view because he was unconscious and possibly brain dead. But I guess implicit is the idea that the parents' view of Archie's best interest might actually conflict with Archie's own best interest, which I think some people will be slightly surprised to hear. I think there's a lot of an assumption that, well, of course, when someone is underage or unconscious, we go to their parents to find out what's right for them. And actually the British legal systems, or the English and Welsh legal system to be precise, says that's not quite right. The parents' view is very important, but it's not absolute determinative.
Yes, I mean, sadly, we all know, both as a society and as doctors, that parents can't always be relied on to make absolutely the best decisions for their children. And what happens, what has evolved, is that parents have a degree of discretion. I mean, a classic example is about immunisation. Should a parent decide whether or not to get their child immunised? Or is that such an important thing that the state has to say, you will immunise them? Well, interestingly, there are different, across the world, different states have come to different decisions on this. But in the UK, we actually value parental rights so highly that we say we will not force parents to immunise their children, even though all the evidence is it is in their child's best interests. But if the parents very strongly feel we don't believe in immunisation and so on, we will try to persuade parents, but we will not force them. So we give them a certain amount the state, society gives parents, in fact, think about issues like immunisation, not only immunisation, you think about education, you think about, you know, how the child is brought up, what the child is taught, all these kind of things. there's a great deal of latitude. However, there is a limit where the state, and the limit comes where a decision of the patient, the decision of the parent, is going to cause substantial harm to the child. At that point, when it appears that what parents are deciding is has the possibility of causing substantial harm, at that point the state feels we must intervene in order to protect the interests of the child. And so in this particular kind of case, yes, we understand the parents are desperately trying to do the best for Archie. We understand parents are not in any kind of way being malevolent. But is it still possible that the longing and the desires of the patients might actually do harm to the child?
And I guess that comes on to the next kind of really critical clash of values, theologies even at this case, which is some people might find it hard to understand how allowing Archie to die could possibly be in his best interest. Is that not causing him the ultimate harm?
Well, of course, this is an issue, again, which technology has risen. As we have become better and better at keeping patients alive, and in particular babies and young children, normally, of course, the right thing to do is to do everything the child can keep a child alive. But increasingly, my own experience as a consultant working in this area as a paediatrician and caring for very young babies is that there is a time when it's possible for the whole life support and intensive care to actually to cause damage. It's possible for it to become a kind of monster. And if I can just tell a completely different story, a true life story, which illustrates this, and which I remember when I first read it, it so struck me. So the story here was of an infant who was a few months old, I think 6-9 months old, who had a terrible accident at home, who I think swallowed a balloon, got very short of oxygen, was rushed into hospital, was resuscitated. But again, rather as in Archie's case, it sadly became apparent that irreversible damage had occurred. And after a few weeks, the doctors told the parents that their child would never survive, there was irreversible brain damage. And the parents asked the doctors, well, in that case, we would like you to switch off the machinery and allow our baby to die in peace and dignity. And the doctors said, no, we can't do that. It's against the law. We have to provide intensive care. And the story was that this went on week after week, that the parents would come and visit. The doctors said, no, nothing's changed. Yes, the baby is not going to survive. No, we're not allowed to switch off the life support treatment. The parents carried on asking. Eventually, the father appeared on the intensive care unit carrying a gun. And the eyewitness accounts say that he held up the staff and he said, I'm not here to hurt anyone, but I just want to... I want to do the best for my child. And it said that he, holding a gun, holding the staff at bay, disconnected the life support machinery, and then cradling his son in his arms, he died, the child. And then at that point, the police had been called. So armed police are now present with their guns. Once the father was confident that the child had actually died, he then handed over the gun and was taken away and charged with homicide. Wow. And just hearing that heart-rending story, I mean, that's an extreme example, but it just shows how what is supposed to be all about doing good and bringing health and restoring children and people to health can actually turn into a sort of strange kind of monster. And therefore, we have to learn when to say enough is enough. There has to be a point at which we have to be able to switch off the life support machinery.
And yet a lot of Christians would disagree quite strongly with that idea. And they would say, hang on, life is not really for us to decide when it starts or when it ends. That's in God's hands. And surely by withdrawing feeding or ventilation or other life support, we're saying we know what's best and we're going to decide that this person needs to die now. Whereas, you know, you often hear the argument that decision should really be left for God. What if God wanted to do a miracle? We need to give space for God to be the ultimate determinant of who lives and who dies. And by kind of grabbing this power for ourselves, and saying, no, I think we know better, we're going to end life support, that is contradictory to kind of the Christian ethic of saying life is a gift from God to give and take away as he chooses.
And of course you can see at least superficially how that seems, that sounds, does that make sense? But if you dig down a bit more deeply, it really doesn't make a great deal of sense, because if you are going to say that ultimately we have to leave all these decisions to God, then really you wouldn't start the medical enterprise at all. Why on earth are we giving penicillin? Because, you know, maybe it was God's plan for that child to die from a pneumonia. And as soon as you intervene with any kind of medical intervention, you're actually playing God, quotes. You are intervening, you are changing the direction. So if you would take an extreme view that God, we must allow God to make the decisions, you would say the entire healthcare enterprise was deeply misguided. And yet nobody seriously says that. Everybody can see how actually God uses the whole medical enterprise. God uses penicillin, God uses intensive care units to bring good and blessing and healing. But these human interventions, which are part of the way that we serve God and achieve the goodness and his ultimate aims within the world, they need to be done with great care and responsibility. And just because we've started doing a treatment, we must also have the right to say we must stop a treatment. I feel very strongly that once we take on any responsibility to intervene, we must also have the right to stop a treatment. I mean, it's ludicrous to think once we've switched on a life support machine, however much damage it's doing, whatever evil consequences are, no, we must never now stop it, because that would be quite wrong. So,
but is there not a distinction between treatment which extends life, like penicillin, and treatment which shortens life, such as withdrawing a feeding tube? I mean, if we see death as the kind of enemy in Christian thinking, then there's a huge distinction between penicillin, which is using artificial means to, which, you know, God has given us to fight and resist death, versus this, what we're talking about here, is using artificial means to hasten death.
Well, not to hasten death, no. So the what is clear, both in UK law and in Christian thinking, at least according as I understand it, is that using any form of intervention, medical treatment, technology in order to kill or in order to accelerate or hasten death is wrong. And certainly that's not what the case of what was being proposed in Archie's case, and it's certainly not the case where I personally have been involved in similar cases in withdrawing life support treatment. The intention when you stop life support treatment is not to bring death. The intention is to stop torturing the patient to no avail. And we've talked about this before, but the essence of ethical medical treatment is to be constantly balancing the benefits and the burdens of medical treatment. And medical treatment which is purely burdensome, which is damaging, which is causing distress, which is causing pain, which is causing tissue damage, but which is doing no benefit, that's the point at which I think it's ethical and right to actually stop treatment where the burdens exceed the benefits.
And in that sense, we say actually there is a Christian tradition that sees death as, yes, something that Jesus came to kind of free us from, but it can sometimes be a mercy. And that's true of maybe the very elderly. And we think, you know, it's not wise if you're, you know, in your 90s approaching death to pursue every last possible form of treatment that might extend you by a few more days. We say, actually, God doesn't want you to resist death at every possible step. Sometimes death is a mercy, and maybe that's also true in the cases of tragically younger children. God doesn't want Archie to die at age 12, but at the position they found himself in with his brain function nil, his organs starting to fail, death at that point could have been a mercy.
Yes, I think that's right. And of course, again, one understands the desperation for parents who want to cling on to any possible hope and who think, you know, perhaps God's going to do a miracle. And yes, the doctors say there's irreversible damage, but is it possible that they're wrong? And so there is this desperation to want to just carry on. But my experience is, if you've been able to develop a relationship of trust between the doctors and the parents, that eventually parents can come to accept that just continuing on and on and on, particularly as they can see that the child is just deteriorating, things are getting worse and so on, that actually the right thing to do is to say enough is enough, and to see that death can become a strange kind of healing, that from a Christian perspective we see physical, biological death as a great evil, but not the greatest evil. There are some things that can be even worse than death, and that death, with the right kind of support, with love, with care, with palliative care and so on, death can turn from being this terrible enemy into a gateway into the new healing. And the only healing that Archie, bless him, is ever going to receive, or could ever receive, is not going to be in this earth. And we pray and long that Archie would be able to receive healing in the new age. We don't know what the future is. We never know what it is, but we trust and hope that by God's grace Archie can receive healing through the gateway of death.
We're running out of time, but just lastly I wanted to touch on one final point before we draw this part of our conversation to a close. I think a lot of Christians instinctively feel like, I'm already opposed to euthanasia and assisted dying. We as Christians are supposed to be pro-life, and therefore that leads them to think, well, I can't be in favour of allowing this, the doctors to kill this child or to let this child die. Do you think those are different issues? Can we be simultaneously very anti-medical professionals' view, you know, the kind of medical professions drifting towards assisted dying, and yet say actually the doctors in this case got it absolutely spot on?
Well, I think we do need to keep a very clear conceptual difference between withdrawing and withholding treatment that is bringing no benefit versus giving intentional treatment which is intended to kill or intended to destroy. And I think one of the sad things that happened in this case is that in Archie's case is in the public discussion there seemed to be some confusion. You know, it was said publicly that this was equivalent to a euthanasia or words to that extent, and that therefore there comes a kind of blurring in the public mind, whereas as far as I'm concerned there is an absolute distinction between withdrawing treatment in a patient who is already dying. I mean, Archie was either, I mean, as we discovered, there was this question about whether he met the criteria for death, but he was dying. He was dying, sadly, from the moment that they started trying to do resuscitation, and that all that months of intensive care did was prolong the process of dying. So there's a stopping treatment and allowing, quotes, that nature to take its course, allowing death to occur, is very different from coming along to a patient who is not dying and injecting a chemical whose sole purpose is to bring instantaneous death. Those two processes, I think, are really quite different, and I, as a Christian, would strongly support withholding and withdrawing treatment in a patient who is dying, like Archie, but I would strongly oppose intentional killing, which is what so-called assisted dying and the legalization of assisted dying is intended to achieve.
Right, well, we've run out of time for this week's episode. Thanks, John. It's been a really interesting discussion. And we're going to pick this up in a part two next week, where we're going to kind of zoom out a little bit and talk about some of the bigger kind of sociological changes at work in the Archie Battersby case and some of the similar cases we've seen in the UK in recent years. Some of the roles around kind of medical paternalism and social media and kind of culture wars, how that's all bleeding together in this way. So do look out for that. But otherwise, as always, you can find more information and resources to kind of stimulate your thinking at John's website. That's johnwyatt.com. And you can get in touch with us. We'd love to hear what you think about this issue. It raises a lot of feelings on both sides of the aisle, I think. You can email us molad@premier.org.uk. But otherwise, we'll speak to you next week. Goodbye. Thank you.
Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.